Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Cover Story, a podcast by New Books Network, where we talk with people who write, edit, and publish long-form journalism. And today we're talking with the publisher and co-editor of N Plus One magazine, Mark Krotov. Mark, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
So before we talk about joys and challenges of editing N Plus One, let's start with your own biography.
Sure. I was born in Russia in the 1980s and came over to the U.S. At age six. And I have no idea if any of the minor linguistic challenges of that transition had any impact on my work. But it was good to once I got familiarized with the English language, I really took to it, and I've been a fan of it ever since. And so I grew up in Atlanta and then basically, you know, came to New York for college and pretty much out of college started working in book publishing. And I, you know, started as an assistant like everyone else and, you know, made copies and did the rest of that stuff. And then gradually, was handed little, you know, chapters of books to edit here and there and really, enjoyed that a lot. That was a truly sort of exciting and transformative experience to just get to play with people's work. And I started with fiction, though I've edited sort of fiction and nonfiction. And then I worked in publishing for about 8 years at a couple different publishers, and then came to N Plus One in 2016.
That's amazing. And I want to ask you more about publishing and also about editing fiction and nonfiction. But I also want to ask you, do you think that the fact that you're essentially bilingual helps or doesn't help in your work as an editor? And I'm thinking, I speak Polish and English, and sometimes I have a problem with self-editing because, you know, certain things are different, like quotation marks, just different punctuation, stuff like that. And I wonder... how it works for you?
That's a great question. It's something that I kind of don't think about very much, except for occasional moments when I think about it very, very intensely. I don't know if this is a partial answer or a definitive answer, but I will say that one big way in which it comes up is I think that I don't have a very good ear for cliche. I think that there are, I really enjoy editing and take it seriously and approach it. You know, I really sort of edit pretty intensely, I think. But I sometimes, you know, N Plus One, we have a very collaborative approach to editing, and we all kind of read one another's edits and try to be helpful and advise one another. But sometimes I'll edit a piece and I'll send it to one of my colleagues for a look. And they will inevitably kind of find a couple of just sort of, you know, minor cliches that someone wrote quickly and sort of unthinkingly. And for all of my various other interventions in this text, it's just like something that I will have missed. And I never know if that's just because I myself just don't actually have that much of a problem with cliche and it's not the thing I focus on, or whether it's actually, you know, whether it does have to do with the language barrier a little bit and that that's just where it manifests.
Yeah. For those listeners who are not familiar with N plus one and what it is about, on the Wikipedia page, you can find an early definition by Keith Gesson, one of the founders, that it's like Paris Review, but not dead. What do you think about this definition? And
Well, that's, you know, I'm very polite. The Paris Review is not dead, of course. But, well, you know, I think that certainly at the time that the magazine was founded, you know, I think that the founding editors, Keith among them, felt very strongly and I think very correctly that there was a real, you know, there was a sort of, this was in 2004, and there was a moment of real sort of political stasis, if not regression, you know, in terms of national politics, obviously, and foreign policy, but also, you know, even in terms of sort of on the left in some sense. And then culturally, they felt similar, that there was just sort of not the kind of combative energy of certain sort of eras of criticism and reviewing and so on were not kind of at the fore, and that the kind of sort of reviewing combat that was happening, like maybe in the pages of the New Republic or elsewhere, that it was kind of not, that in a way it was so sort of a superficial kind of combat. And so, yes, and so they wanted to create something that was very, very, very much alive and alive to the moment in politics, you know, alive to sort of contemporary literature and alive to sort of the possibilities of form that maybe other places were not as interested in experimenting with. And, you know, and I think that that continues to manifest. One thing that we have a kind of, you know, I suppose it's an unwritten rule, but we are not, it's not like private or anything, but we have something called a no dead people rule, where for, you know, with very, very minor exceptions, we don't publish reviews of, like, we wouldn't publish like a review of, you know, of a Philip Roth novel or even of his work mm-hmm. now, you know, because he's just not alive. We might publish something on, you know, the kind of all the controversy and stuff. But so that's a way to, you know, obviously many, many great writers and thinkers among the dead, so many great ones. But we really try to, you know, to limit ourselves to kind of to contemporaneity and to say, okay, well, given the choice between maybe relitigating however elegantly something that has been sort of discussed to death or trying to contribute something new, we're just like much more interested in the latter. And I think that's really held true from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned before that you were an avid reader of N+1 yourself before you actually joined them. So do you remember yourself as a reader of N+1 and what got you excited? Maybe you remember some pieces or writers in particular? I'm not sure if that's a fair question to ask.
No, of course. I first encountered the magazine. So it was founded in 2004 and I probably came to it in 2006 or early 2007. So I wish I had been able to say that I've been reading it from the very beginning, but it's not quite true. But, mm-hmm. But I encountered it in college and I was just so, you know, essentially the thing that struck me so powerfully was that you could just have culture and politics and literature just in the same sharing space, you know, and talking to one another. And these things were not segregated. And I think that really resonated with me as a reader. That's something that I've always been interested in political writing in one form or another. And I've always been interested in reading about, you know, in writing about politics that's kind of not just strictly factual or strictly sort of narrative, though of course those things have their place, but that takes real formal risks and that tries to sort of approach politics in a sort of with, you know, in a really kind of literary sophisticated way, but also interested in literature that doesn't just sort of like leave politics or ideology unstated. That's not to say, of course, that like all of our fiction is screed or manifesto. I mean, nothing, I think that's, it's quite far from the truth. And I think we're very rigorous about the fiction that we publish, but certainly that combination of things was just so bracing. And I remember, I remember buying issue 5 at the great like magazine store on the Upper West Side that is no longer there. It was right on the front table, you know, and next to the checkout area. And just like holding it in my hand, and it was really exciting. And that piece has a lot of great writing. I mean, that issue has a lot of great writing. Keith, who you mentioned, has this piece about torture and sort of American foreign policy in that issue. It's so elusive and so interesting, and it kind of like builds by accretion rather than sort of saying things directly or declaratively. And I I've read that piece so many times over the years, and always have taken away something new from it. And the other thing from that issue that really stood out and I think was quite kind of was quite fundamental was a great piece by the writer Imran Kuvadia, a short story called Dr. Atomic, which is based on the life of A.Q. Khan, the nuclear scientist from Pakistan, who kind of in the 90s and the 2000s worked for like various quote unquote rogue nations, helping them to develop their nuclear programs. And he worked in with the North Korean government. And so the story basically follows this. I don't remember if he was named or not. He might just be, the story's called Dr. Atomic. But in any case, it follows him through his time in Pyongyang as he's just sort of navigating the city and sharing his expertise. And I just thought that, I mean, I just thought it was such an amazing topic for a short story. You know, it's very ripped from the headlines, of course, but it's so, so subtle and so unusual in its construction and in its approach that it doesn't feel, it just has this kind of real mystical quality almost.
Sounds amazing. And so at the moment you do most of the assigning, you manage writers and content pretty much. And how does that work? What does it take to put an issue together? How do you guys pick a theme and the title, and how much time does it take? If you could tell us a bit about your work as an editor.
Sure. So the magazine comes out 3 times a year. And, you know, usually we start with a submissions sort of meeting in which all the editors on the editorial board bring in pieces that they're interested in having considered for the magazine. You know, that can be fiction, it can be nonfiction, it can be criticism, it can be, you know, it can be sort of more straightforwardly political writing. It can be by them, it can be by other people, but basically it's stuff that they will have sort of solicited and developed for the preceding, you know, 4 months or possibly longer, sometimes much, much longer. You know, sometimes our pieces are like kind of in quote unquote gestation for years. And then everybody reads everything. And then we have a meeting, where we sort of take the temperature and talk through the pieces and sort of figure out, who likes what, who doesn't like what, and the goal is not so much to leave the meeting with a firm sense of what is going in the issue, so much as to really sort of talk through potential challenges to pieces, to talk through what, to sort of gauge what is really exciting and what's motivating. And then also, you know, sometimes stuff just won't really, you know, rise to the level of conversation at all. And that kind of tells us something too. And so then at that point, the co-editors, which at the moment, you know, it kind of changes. But at the moment, that's me and my colleague, Dana Tortorici. We go off and sort of like figure out the table of contents. And then at that point, you know, there's like another few rounds of editing that happen. And then it's, you know, it's fairly straightforward. Things get fact checked, things go into copy editing, things get proofread, things, you know, and so on. And, but, you know, but we, N plus one is all, you know, one of the other things that struck me when I, and I don't know that I could have articulated this, you know, when I was not like 19 years old or whatever, 21 years old, mm-hmm. I'm sure I couldn't have, was that it's a, you know, it at the, it was obviously at the time, just an extraordinarily well-edited magazine. And I'm not saying that, I'm allowed to say that because I was not involved mm-hmm. with it at the time. So I was just speaking as a reader, you know, it really struck me that the, that it just had a real voice and a real sensibility. And so we, and so, yeah, so, you know, that's the big thing is we really take editing very seriously. I believe that editing is, you know, it's not like a self-involved belief. It's not as important as the writing or whatever. And I think the kind of power, the sort of like the power relationship between author and editor, I think is in fact, something that I really take seriously and that we all take seriously, which is to say that, you know, we believe in like, and the author having, you know, the say and really being a part of the process. But at the same time, the best pieces tend to be the, or many of the best pieces, let's say. Sometimes there's all kinds, but some of the stuff that I like, I really enjoy working on is stuff that has emerged from conversation between author and editor over months or years, you know, that doesn't mm-hmm. kind of just, sometimes something incredible can develop in a vacuum. And we have a number of writers who really just kind of go off, do their thing, present something, and it's incredible. But other kinds of writing, I think, really benefit from editorial involvement very early on, even before there's strictly speaking anything to edit, you know. And so that's what we sort of take that as a, that's key to our vision of how of the kind of writing that we want to publish.
Mm-hmm. But then on the top of that, you also have a growing content that is present only on the web, right? So how does that content place, you know, with the themed issues, you know?
Yeah, well, yes, I mean, I think so basically, the, you know, I think the main sort of, there's like just a process difference, which is that the print, you know, all the print pieces are kind of go through, you know, they're read by everyone on EdBoard and they're sort of discussed collectively and decided, and to a certain extent, you know, people weigh in and then they take a long time to come out, you know, because the magazine only comes out 3 times a year. The web is, it's a little more, you know, it's obviously more immediate. We can run more topical stuff. And also we have a kind of a setup where pieces that go on the web don't, like, they don't have to go through that whole EdBoard process. So, you know, we as long as there's like two editors in the editorial board who feel that a piece is interesting and worth publishing and ready to publish, then that's fine. You know, and that's a way for us to mm-hmm. kind of not, it's a way for us to be responsive and for us to also publish work that's still, I mean, you know, there's stuff on the website that I think is everything is every bit as good as what's in the print. I don't think it's I don't think it's sort of a qualitative distinction per se, but sometimes you want something out very soon, you know, very quickly. Sometimes something is formally super interesting, really ambitious, something we want to commit to, but maybe not quite right for the magazine, you know, for whatever reason, maybe it's too long. Maybe just stylistically, it's kind of a little bit at odds with the tone of the magazine, but still something we really want to pursue. And other times, you know, it might just be, it's also like, it's a great way to, you know, for us to kind of also work with emerging writers as well, you know, because I think you don't have to, there's like, I don't want to say that there's sort of less polish on the web, because that's certainly not always the case, but it is the case that, you know, we might just be, especially in the interest of topicality or something, we might very well say, okay, well, this piece is still, you know, if we were to have this in print, we might want to kind of really, sand off the edges a little bit, not in kind of in a political sense, but in a sort of literary sense, but know this thing exists as it is, and we like it, and we want it to respond to the moment now. So that's kind of how the, you know, it's sort of a distinction in that sense, but certainly everyone on EdBoard is encouraged to and does kind of bring pieces in for both channels.
Mm-hmm. And you yourself, two recent pieces that you penned were published not under your name, but as the editors in the section that you guys called the intellectual situation, right? And the most recent of them was The Consequences of Deferred Maintenance. And I was wondering, the voice of this piece and other pieces is very distinct. So I wonder how the editor's pieces are being born. I'm sorry. You guys have a meeting and come up and you come to certain agreement and then this voice represents you all.
It's really different every time. The intellectual situation, with some exceptions, it's generally unsigned. Sometimes it's written by one editor. Sometimes it's written by two editors. Sometimes it's truly like highly collaborative, where there's a giant email thread and everyone sort of writes in, and then someone takes on the responsibility of sort of stitching the thing together. My colleague Rachel Ossip, who's our managing editor and a really brilliant editor in her own right, is just like, she's a real, she's among other kinds of editing, she's extremely good at doing the stitching work, where she can kind of see all the constituent parts and then sort of patch them together. And then that gives us like a sense of that's maybe not a full finished draft, but it's something that has the right shape. That's really to say that like there's no hard and fast way to do it. Obviously, in a perfect world, I mean this seriously, in a perfect world, like the intellectual situation would truly be written collectively, because we want the Edwards voice sort of represented democratically. In practice, that sometimes that does work, and then at other times, conversations are happening, and then one or a few editors go off and write the thing, and then kind of present an unfinished version to the Ed board, and then that gets discussed, and then sort of changes are integrated, or edits are made, feedback is received, criticism is accepted, and so on. And it's interesting because like if you look at the kind of the intellectual situation, that opening sort of quote unquote op-ed throughout the history of the magazine, it's evolved in a lot of different directions. It used to be, in the past, in the early issues, the intellectual situation section was like, it was really short, and there'd be like three or four or five different short essays that would constitute the whole. And then periodically you'd have longer single pieces that, sometimes there's two of them. In recent, in issue 37, which we published last summer late last spring, which came out, essentially was our an issue that we'd mostly finished working on when COVID, when the lockdown started. And then of course we the issue was not done then at that point. And so we really kind of had to rethink it and ended up publishing a lot more stuff in it than we would have before. That's an issue where the intellectual situation has four distinct signed pieces, so it really changes. I think we would all like to publish like shorter versions of this thing because it's like a lot of work and a lot of time, and we always want to do more funny stuff. On the whole, we've been pretty serious recently, though. I think in issue 36, the one about publishing has some kind of stupid mm-hmm. jokes in it, which is great. we do want stuff to be funny. I haven't really emphasized that, but I think we really actually appreciate that it's a very serious looking magazine with like serious looking covers and so forth. And I love that seriousness and I'm committed to it. But at the same time, humor in that context can really do a lot of work. And some of my favorite N+1, contributors are also the funniest.
Okay, so staying for a bit in a publishing world, do you think that this is a coincidence that right now you are doing the magazine, or you think that you're consciously left the world of book publishing? Your piece about publishing was pretty bitter.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a bitter. Oh, man. Yeah, I guess it was probably bitter. I'm actually not. I'm not that. I think of myself with relation to book publishing. I don't think of myself as bitter, but I do think of myself as kind of like a critic from within, in a sense. I don't. That's a great question. I mean, I think that. Well, first of all, I should say that N+1, in addition to the magazine and the website, we also publish books periodically, and so initially when I was brought in, that was kind of one of the things that I was tasked with overseeing, and so we've published some great books, which we can talk about later, or well, we don't have to, but in any case, but yeah, I mean, I think now certainly more of my work is on the magazine, just because like the book projects kind of are. They come and go, but it couldn't be a full-time concern for us. I don't know. I mean, I think that book publishing, no, I mean, it's an important, it's a crucial industry. It has so much to offer. I think that it's certainly being at a magazine, and especially being at this magazine is, I don't know. It's more fun. You know, you don't have to spend like many years working on something. The gratification's a lot more immediate because you just publish something and you see it reach readers. Books, the problem with book publishing in a way is that the part of book publishing that I've spent most of my working life in is that books are very, every book is different, and every book kind of has a different audience, and there's a lot of overlap for sure, but it's you really, to do book publishing really well, in a sense, you have to do a bit of reinventing the wheel every single time, and nobody has the capacity to do that. You know, there's no publisher that can really devote, I mean, with a couple of exceptions, but even there, you know, I think it's just so, you have to do, not only do you have to get the editing right, and you have to, you know, find the great books and cultivate the writers, you then have to put an enormous amount of effort into help, you know, into getting these books' attention and helping them find readers. Whereas like every development in kind of culture and technology over the past, you know, decade or 15 years has in a sense militated against that, you know, with the rise of Amazon being a kind of central element of that, but by no means is that the only thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, to answer your question, I find magazine work extremely rewarding and exciting, and I think it's a great way to, it's easier to find new writers and young writers and exciting writers and writers from underrepresented or just interesting or backgrounds or both who will write an article. It's like, that's a much easier ask than trying to get them to write a book, you know? But that being said, I believe that we are, you know, part of a shared ecosystem, and nothing is more exciting to us than when our writers go on to write books that either sort of expand or elaborate on the pieces they've written for us, or just simply are totally different, but in one way or another, we helped them take kind of the next step. And we're like, you know, we are very enthusiastic about promoting those books, even if they're not books that we've published ourselves. And of course, you know, everybody reads constantly. So, so anyway, sorry, that's a very long answer. I think that my final kind of, in a sense, I think that the kind of the problems with book publishing are, you know, it's just they're just serious structural problems, and I do wish that and you know, the piece in issue 36, I think, to the extent that it's bitter about the fact that the people at the sort of at the top tier of these companies, the people who make the most money and who run them, feel to me, maybe with one exception, feel quite I don't know that they have a kind of long-term vision for the sustainability of the industry. And certainly, you know, over the past decade, when Amazon, let's say 15 years, you know, when Amazon went from like a very significant retailer to being, in some cases, near monopolistic as a retailer, and then went from, you know, a physical retailer to having the Kindle, which is dominant in a way that in fact, like, I think is hard to grasp, even though so many people own this thing and read on it. That was a time for, for CEOs and executives in publishing to take very, very seriously, to take Amazon seriously as an enemy, rather than as like, a force to be placated. And I just think that for the most part, that has not happened. And so now, you know, now we're really in the position where we are, where despite some like incredible, you know, work in independent bookstores and certain online retailers or so on, you know, the book publishing and readers are in large part in thrall to one company. And that's a real problem.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Definitely. There is actually a book that I want to talk about by N+1, and that would be MFA versus New York City, the book that I really, really loved read a few times, and it read really fresh. So when you were talking about publishing, I thought that you guys back then at least found this really successful formula to publish a fresh book. I don't know if that was before your time or were you involved in the project. And also, I was wondering, what makes you guys decide that you guys have in hand an idea that potentially deserves to be changed into a book published by N+1?
That's a great question. I was not around then, and I love that book and think it's kind of a model of the kind of work that we, the kind of books that we can publish and do publish and should publish more of. I think it's just really, it's just a really kind of exciting and sort of interesting intervention. And it found all kinds of readers, right? Because in fact, people, you know, to the extent that the sort of MFA versus NYC distinction is a strict one, it really found readers on both sides of that. I love more than going to sort of fairs and conferences and tabling with, you know, for N+1, literally just standing behind the table trying to make deals like a used car salesman. During the COVID era, of course, that has not been possible. But when I've gone to the, to the AWP conference, which is kind of the big like hub of the MFAs, that's like definitely a book that resonates, even though, and people are very interested in it. And so in any case, an amazing book that I think kind of has a great combination of sort of literary sophistication and sort of serious sociology and sort of interestingly turns, you know, and like turns kind of readers and readership and the market sort of back in on the readers and makes them feel sort of part of and implicated in a series of structures and systems. And like, what, you know, what more could you ask for in a way? To answer the second question, there's not like a strict formula for when something kind of quote unquote rises to like, you know, might like rise to the level of a book. And the past few books that we've done have been sort of single author books. So in 2017 we were working with a writer who's also, you know, an artist and a journalist, and she kind of does graphic reportage. So she just draws these incredible images of mostly sites of protest in the former Soviet Union, but also, you know, is kind of does really serious journalism. She goes out and talks to people and she writes stuff down, but mostly she just has these amazing pictures. And so that was somebody that we'd published in the magazine, but of course we're like, this has to be a book. And so that kind of happened that way. And we've since published her work. This is Victoria Lomasko, the author of Other Russias. We published her numerous mm-hmm. times, including in the most recent issue in 39, yes. where she has a great dispatch on the uprising Minsk. In Belarus.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, then in 2018, we published a book by a collection of film writing by our longtime film critic, A.S. Hamra, who he's currently at the Baffler, but he'd written for us for many, many years. And, I'm trying to keep hyperbole in this conversation to a minimum, but I'll say that he's the best film critic in the English speaking world. And is a genius. And so we were like, well, this seems, he'd been writing for us for a long time, but then he'd been writing for other places for even longer. And we sort of felt, well, okay, this is a person who we and a lot of readers, our readers, take very, very seriously, but can we, in a sense, can we make them take him even more seriously and kind of really just, can we make the kind of the essay collection, the collection of criticism, become a kind of an event, you know? And so that's exactly what we did and what happened. And that book, The Earth Dies Streaming, has been really successful and we're just about to reprint it again. And Hamra, you know, as a result, you know, partly as a result of just that book, has gone on to sort of, you know, just write even more and is somehow getting even better. And his stature has certainly grown and his profile has grown. And that's a great case where that was just not, that was certainly an editorial decision, but it was an editorial decision in a kind of larger sense where you kind of said, okay, well, we know this thing is great. This thing already exists. All the pieces in the book, except for the introduction, had already been published. Mm-hmm. But the fact of kind of arranging them in a certain way making a book out of them and giving it, you know, this an incredible cover, again by Rachel Ossip, who I mentioned, and by giving it this great title that Hamra came up with, we can really turn it into something special, something that if it only existed in the magazine would actually not quite rise to the level of this level of attention, you know, because like the magazine, for all of its visibility and for all of its readers, an issue of the magazine doesn't really have like a publicity cycle, you mm-hmm. know, whereas a book really does. And, people get interviewed when they publish a book and they get reviewed, of course. So that was so fun to take advantage of and of that kind of reality. And it's really one of the things I'm most proud of, in my whole professional life is helping get that book together and getting it out.
In your piece on publishing, you are mentioning the growing role of audio in book publishing. And I was wondering what audio does to long-form journalism. I can see that N+1 avoided the trend of having a podcast, which is probably great. I was wondering what you think about audio in you know, in the world of magazines? And do you think it's going to take away all the readership? Yeah. Any thoughts?
Yeah. Well, you know, we actually did, have a podcast for a while. That was really fun. Mm-hmm. It was run by our, by some of our interns and former interns. It was, and I think they did awesome work. And then, like, you know, like any reasonable person, they got jobs that were more real than the N+1 podcast. And so, you know, we've kind of been trying to relaunch it ever since, but it's somehow never quite converge on something, you know, cause like, of course one wants it to be good and not, and it, I mean, it was good, but like one would really have to start over and make it pretty sophisticated and so on. So it's tricky. Yeah, I don't know that I have actually that many informed thoughts on you know, on one hand, I don't know. I mean, I think that obviously there's like
audio?
An incredible, do I, yeah, but it's mostly like, it's kind of sad. My audio listenership is pretty, it's pretty lowbrow, you know, like I don't listen to, like, I read reporting, of course, but I don't know that I've listened to like you know, a kind of serious, like, reported podcast in a long time. And that's not, to some extent, it's just because I, when I'm not reading for work and when I'm not editing, I kind of just want to consume. But also when I'm, like, I don't know, doing the dishes, I want to sort of consume slightly more stupid stuff. So maybe that's part of it. I mean, I will say that, and I kind of, this is like, you know, you should treat this as a pretty uninformed judgment. I do think that the thing with like certain varieties of long form journalism is that I think there's like a kind of danger of like of a certain kind of fetishism where, you know, where you have a good story, but then there's like all this kind of set dressing around it, you know, where like and that can mean that like the reporting is very much in the first person. It can mean that there's kind of just like big set pieces and so on. But I'm, you know, I'm very, I love flourishes, you know, but I prefer for flourishes to kind of exist in, like in fiction or in sort of more essayistic nonfiction. Whereas like I see report, you know, to me reporting at its peak is kind of stuff like, you know, is really just frankly stuff in the New Yorker where, the writers, for all their kind of audacity and success as reporters, really do get out of the way for the most part. And it's really hard to get out of the way in an audio medium because your voice is the thing, you know? And so I don't know. I mean, but that's a kind of very tentative answer because I don't actually have very strong feelings about this. I mean, obviously one thing is that, of course, like it is amazing to, you know, to hear from people and to hear sort of voices that are not, that just like otherwise don't quite like, you know, live on the page in the same way. And so I do find, I, you know, I mean, I listened to a couple of seasons of The Slow Burn when it launched, you know, and Leon, when Leon Neyfakh was still doing it. And, you know, and the stuff that stayed with me from that, and I thought that was awesome, but the stuff that really stayed with me about that, you know, from those podcasts was just like getting to listen to Leon's interview with Linda Tripp, you know, and like actually listening to some of the public or semi-public, or in fact, like not at all public figures themselves. I mean, I think that those, getting that kind of texture was extremely valuable. And, 'cause otherwise, like, you know, re-reporting the Clinton impeachment in a sense is like, that's not, one wouldn't kind of do that without the sort of added capacity of actually letting these voices speak. So I think that's great. But most of the time, I shouldn't say they're stupid because they're very, you know, sometimes they can be interesting, but I listen to kind of like pretty amateurish movie podcasts, you know, where people just talk about movies and I use that mostly as like a way to write down stuff that I want to watch at some point. I'm pretty exploitative in a sense, right? That the quality of the conversation in a way interests me less than like what I can draw from it.
So I would like to ask you if you're using different tools to edit fiction versus nonfiction. I was just wondering if it feels different to an editor to work with fiction or not, you know?
No, I mean, when I started out when I was in book publishing, I have this like very clear memory of the first, like when my boss gave me three chapters of a novel that she was working on to edit. I think the first three chapters. And I printed them out and then sat in like a Starbucks or something on like a rainy evening, just sitting there editing these chapters, you know, with a pen. And that was just like really like few high points, few moments in my career have matched how exciting and sort of really just liberating that felt. That I bring that up only to say that, like, you know, for the most part, I think I was working at like with pen and paper, like at that time. I mean, I was definitely using track changes for things, but I don't think that really changed. I think I was mostly paper, but now, you know, it kind of sucks, but I can't tell you the last time that I edited fiction or nonfiction on paper. And partly it's because I am like, you know, I don't know. Well, now we also like didn't have a printer. Now my wife and I have a printer. So maybe I can do that again. For fiction, I would feel, I don't really have different approaches to fiction and nonfiction or different technologies or whatever. I suppose that it would be easier to edit fiction on paper because like, you know, those edits tend to be less interventionist or rather they can be interventionist, but I'm not like moving huge chunks of text around for the most part in fiction. Whereas in nonfiction, you know, I actually find track change. I know that like track changes is like a pretty traumatic medium for writers, and I am sensitive to that. And so I always have like some caveats when I email edits to writers, which, you know, and sometimes I say like, actually, it's better to just read this without the changes first. But I'm very attached to track changes. At the same time, some of my colleagues do this great thing where they kind of don't, where they don't really. And I think this maybe was our former editor Nikhil Saval, who's now a state senator in Pennsylvania, and you know, so he still does stuff this way, and you know, in the state house. But I think he would kind of mostly edit in bold. And so he would just kind of cut chunks, but you wouldn't necessarily see the cuts. And then you would see his kind of like interested new writing in bold. Mm. And then he would ask questions in bold and brackets. That's a pretty smart approach. It's great. I sometimes from my perspective, it's helpful for me to like, as an editor, to see my cuts. And yeah, but I don't know. I mean, but so yeah, I have no, I'm really like technologically, you know, some of my colleagues use Google Drive or, you know, Google Docs. I really don't like that so much, and find it pretty frustrating. But sorry, this is like very, this is very in the weeds, but you are making me realize that, that the next time I'm editing fiction, I should probably, you know, give the printer a try. Cause that's really, it's a much nicer feeling, of course, to be doing that than to be, just be looking at your screen the same way that you are otherwise anyway.
N+1 is a nonprofit that also relies on subscriptions, correct? And how are you guys doing these years after two recent disasters? I mean, Trump and the pandemic. Was it good for, for example, was the experience of the pandemic, was it good for readership of N+1? And when I mentioned Trump, of course, I meant that during his presidency, a lot of magazines experience, a surge of new readers. So whatever you can tell us about the experience of recent years for N+1.
Yeah, I mean, it's been very steady. We definitely experienced like a bump in subscriptions after the 2016 election in the way that lots of publications did. I don't think ours was kind of as extreme as in some places, partly because we were not, you know, I mean, we just weren't, like, obviously we responded to events in, I think, a really great and lucid way, and some of our best writing is from that, you know, from that period. And I think we got over the shock pretty quickly and just sort of went to work. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that we like leaned into sort of the resistance or whatever, while also obviously kind of opposing, you know, opposing Trump and Trumpism very vigorously. And so, so I think that it was a bump, but it wasn't like, we didn't like double our readership or anything. And then in the pandemic, certainly, especially, I'm extremely proud of what, you know, my colleagues and I managed to pull off kind of in the first few months of the pandemic. Our web editor at the time, Marco Roth, was really sort of overseeing this effort. And we just published a lot of really, really good lasting writing on the pandemic really, really quickly. And in fact, in the first couple months, like between, you know, March, April, May. And then we partnered with Verso Books, to turn a lot of that writing and then a lot of the great stuff that Verso had published on their website as well, into an ebook called There Is No Outside, which is available from us or from Verso. You know, it's like a couple bucks. And I was really happy with that, with how that came together too, you know, and especially looking back over some of those pieces now, a year later, it's kind of just, I mean, everybody was in shock, but it's kind of awesome how quickly our writers were thinking, how well they were writing, how sort of diligently our editors responded and stepped up. And if you look at that collection, that There Is No Outside, it's kind of what's striking, I think, is that, and if you look at our website from that time, what's really impressive is that it's just such a range of kinds of writing. You know, we had more personal stuff. We had really sort of pretty high level political analysis. We had pretty urgent sort of dispatches from people really heavily implicated and affected by the pandemic. I think that kind of range of diversity really speaks to, you know, it speaks to our sensibility that we're always hoping to approach contemporaneity in a lot of different ways simultaneously.
What's coming up? Are you guys working on the spring issue? And also, could you tell us about N+1 Writers Award?
Oh, yes, of course. We're working on the spring issue. We're getting pretty close. That's an issue I'm very, very, very excited about and proud of.
People
are just waiting with bated breath or whatever. But I will say that one piece that's going to be in it is a piece that we just published on the website, just a week ago by Toby Hazlitt, his really magisterial essay on last summer's uprising kind of a year later, and his effort to sort of re-narrate that story, which has been, for various kind of active and passive reasons, I think suppressed a little bit in the memory, but also to sort of to think through what its implications and possibilities are going forward. And that piece was like a, you know, that was, you know, we published that on a Friday and it's just, people were reading it really actively over the weekend and have been reading it since. And I think it was a very, very, very popular piece. And I'm so thrilled by that, partly because I think Toby Hazlitt is really, he's really one of the great writers of our time. I'm so, again, that's my second hyperbole of the podcast, so forgive me, but it's really true. And this piece is, you know, it's really long. It covers so much ground. It has like phenomenal personal observation of the riots. It also has really serious analysis. It covers, it of course covers economics, and it covers you know, a lot of the kind of anti-carceral intellectual work that has been done to sort of bring some of these conditions about. And it's also sort of internationalist in its final pages. Anyway, just a remarkable essay. And so to see the incredible readership that showed up for it, the people that responded to it so strongly, that was just so encouraging. You know, nothing is more exciting than to have, you know, than to have like thousands and thousands and thousands mm-hmm. of readers read a 10,000 word piece that is not self-evident. You know, it's not a take. It's just something truly unique. So that's going to be in the issue. We're going to, you know, sometimes stuff that, for the most part, things that are in print, you know, have not appeared on the web before, but there are always exceptions, and this is like a kind of self-evident one to make.
Okay. And maybe just a couple of sentences about the N+1 Writers Award.
Yes, thank you for yes. So we're all really excited about that as well. So typically, in a non-pandemic context, we have an annual fundraiser. As you said, we rely heavily on subscriptions. Subscriptions are the most important. Just subscriptions are what keep us sustainable ultimately. And that's like the most important thing that anyone can do to support us is just to subscribe. It really means a lot. But we also, of course, try to, you know, like every nonprofit, we apply for grants and we raise money from donors. And so every year, in normal years, we have a fundraiser where we raise money, and then we give out something called the N+1 Writers Fellowship, which is basically a $5,000 prize with no strings attached at all to someone who has contributed to the magazine, you know, over a number of years, and who we think really kind of is just an essential contributor in one way or another. And the winners of that award have been, it really kind of runs the gamut. Like one year, Bella Shaevich, the great translator and writer, won that award. And she hadn't actually technically written very much for us, but she'd translated so much. She'd been so key to the magazine in so many different ways, and had edited so many pieces and brought in so much work, including Victoria Lamasco's book. And so, sometimes it's contributions like that. Sometimes it's people who have just written a lot and who we think are really key. And so this year's winner is Christina Nickel, who's just an absolutely exceptional novelist and essayist, who has someone who I've worked with now for almost a decade, because I published her novel many years ago. And so we've had a relationship since like 2012, I think. That's when we first, when I first read the book, once I started at N+1, I was very, very excited to get her into the magazine. And so she's published three really big essays for us, that are just so strange and so funny and just so, she's just an explorer in a sense. And she, you just never know where she's going or what she's going to do next. And she has such a, she's just amazing. So I'm very, very happy that we're giving her the fellowship prize. And then, the other award. Because we don't have this, because we can't have a gala, we're doing this thing over Zoom where we just give out the award portion. But then kind of the slightly sadder, but still exciting part of this is that one of our really, really essential contributors, somebody who we published, who we published his story in issue 31, which that was actually also first issue Christina's work appeared in. And he went, that really helped launch his career. This is the writer Anthony Viasna-So, who was really kind of a once in a generation fiction writer and also essayist. And he died late last year in December. He was 28, so young. His short story collection, he had just finished, I think, basically looking over the proofs for it. And that collection is coming out in August from Echo Press. And, um, And, you know, he was just like, not just by us, he was widely seen as this, like, as a kind of major new voice, you know? And so everyone in the magazine was so fond of him. He, you know, he was friends with all the editors. He was friends with the interns. He was just the most charming and warm and creative person, while also just like, you know, writing work at this, like, this incredible caliber. So we published two stories by him and two essays. And in any case, so we kind of felt that there was no way to, like, in a way, there was like no way to do, to honor him without, unless it was in some way that, like, would keep honoring him. And so we came up with this fiction prize named in his honor, the Anthony Vyasnesov Fiction Prize. And so that's just a, that's a prize that we're going to give out every year. And so, which means that every year we'll get to say his name and really acknowledge his contributions. And so the winner of that prize is a really great, the inaugural winner is a really great short story writer named Trevor Shikaze, who's in Vancouver, who has published two very long, really kind of batshit stories with us that are sort of dystopian and just totally, you know, it's so funny because dystopia usually sort of implies like a certain amount of heaviness and doom and gloom. And it's not that that's absent from these stories, but they're also just so wacky. And they're kind of, they're sort of, their situations are at once so ridiculous and so kind of grounded. It's like, I don't know, it's like slacker dystopia is maybe the best way that I would describe it. And so he's just, you know, he's amazing. And I don't think anybody else would have published, you know, like two 10,000 word short stories. Maybe they would have, but in any case, we're really proud and honored to have done it. So, so he's the recipient. And so, yeah, so we're going to do a thing on May 26th on Zoom where we'll honor both Christina and Trevor. And we'll also have a little, you know, a little time where we talk about Anthony. And, you know, I mean, I think I'm sure everyone wants to get off Zoom. I know I do. But I also think this will just be a really, I just think this will be really lovely, actually. And yeah. I'm excited to share it with our readers.
A lot of things to check out, it seems, and a lot of things coming. Mark, thank you so much for your time. Good luck with everything. And yeah, today we were talking with the publisher and co-editor of N+1, Mark Kroto. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much.